From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Last week on this program, I suggested that David Lipsky's latest book was sort of like the section of the Hebrew Scriptures where we become privy to the lineage that leads from Adam to Noah and the Great Flood. In that analogy, last week's episode got us through Jared, maybe Enoch. We're probably not quite at Methuselah yet. So we've done something unusual. We've broken the episode into two parts. And today we're going to get to the second half of our chat. And the premise of this conversation is this: our climates are changing as a result of greenhouse gases, and we've actually known that for a very long time. And there was actually very little debate on that point for many decades. Through the administrations of Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and the first part of the Bush years, the science was widely accepted. Between Republicans and Democrats, it was really only the policies on what to do about it that differed. But that has since changed. And the factors that went into that change are at the heart of Lipsky's latest book. Lipsky teaches at New York University, and he's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and The New York Times. And if you've seen the film The End of the Tour, you know David. He's the one who's played in that road trip movie by the actor Jesse Eisenberg. Lipsky's new book is called The Parrot and the Igloo.
I love stories. You know, what brought me into writing is just loving stories and accepting. There's that great Joan Didion line. It's so famous. It's one of those things that you feel a little embarrassed quoting because it's almost on T-shirts. It's, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. You could just cut that back to, we tell ourselves stories. Like, that's the way that we absorb data. And so I wanted to, so that people could understand how far back this goes, and so they could never be misled again by either well-meaning politicians, or even more importantly, by dark-minded politicians, or by commercial interests, that it would be impossible. And the way to do that would be to make this as fun as any other book you could read. And the way to do that was to tell human people stories. But here's what happened, and this is the last section of the book, which is the mayor from the Jaws town. How do we keep this quiet, basically? Frank Luntz is a genius. Luntz was a genius with mood and opinion and what you can say to someone who's a colleague, or what you say when you're leaving the gym together. And he would run different words by focus groups, and he would see which ones made them sleep and which ones made them jump. And for his purposes and for his clients' purposes, you wanted the ones that would make people kind of sleepy. And so the Republican Party hired him to help with the environment, to help with this problem of global warming. He goes to his team of average citizens and he said, okay, so we got to stop saying global warming because that phrase has catastrophic connotations associated with it. However, if we can train ourselves to say climate change, that sounds like a much more measurable challenge, a much more easily faced challenge. It will sound like in December or January, flying from Ohio to Fort Lauderdale for the weekend. So we really have to be careful to only say climate change. And the awful thing is, he's an expert. Edison was able to pull the wire for electricity into all our homes. And people like Frank Luntz have been able to wire our opinions in ways where we think we're speaking our hearts and our opinions, and they are steepling their fingers together and tapping them and smiling in the background like satisfied Bond villains.
And this is sort of the cultural milieu that Mark Cerise is swimming in when he's, you know, a respected scientist, but not really feeling confident enough to say, like, this is crazy, we got to do something.
Not an alarmist. So Dr. Cerise is one of the scientists at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. And his job is to monitor the cryosphere, which is the world's cold places. And so this data starts coming in about the ice flows, basically, around Greenland, which is, we have the seasonal ice, which forms, I think there it forms in the summer, and it is forming later and it's forming thinner. And Mark Cerise, who is just a sober, non-hand-waving type scientist, says, there's no reason to be worried. We've seen things like this before. We've seen them again. And then the numbers keep being bad. And then he begins saying, look, I've said this before. I'm sort of a fence sitter. We can't say this is related to global warming. We can't say that it isn't. We have to wait for more data to come in. And as the data comes in and it begins being more and more extreme, by 2007, he says this haunting thing, which is the Arctic is screaming.
And then there comes this really frightening single week in 1983. Two reports come out, one from the EPA, the other from the National Academies of Science. But the second one says something that hasn't been said quite as forcefully before, which is that this problem is intractable, sure, but you can cope. And the reason it says this ties into this guy, William Nirenberg.
Nirenberg was politically, he was in political sympathy, philosophical sympathy with the Reagan White House. And what the science advisor said years later is we put our guy on it and he kept an eye on the issue. So all the scientists for the National Academy of Sciences are saying, this is bad. This is intractable. This is going to start hitting us now if it isn't already hitting us now. And he is the person who writes the introductory chapter and he writes the conclusion. And he does something that is much more palatable to the Reagan White House. So the EPA report, and this is 83, and Tom Brokaw gets on NBC and says, our earthly paradise is heating at an alarming rate and there isn't much we can do about it. That's what the EPA says. The National Academy of Sciences report says the exact same thing, but the person who's summarizing it for consumption by reporters says, you know, we can cope. And he says something that's very similar to what Frank Luntz says. Climate change for a planet might not be that different from climate change like we had in the 30s, where the Joads would move from Oklahoma to California. And not only have Americans dealt with that, they've also brought their livestock and their pets with them. And so the science advisor for the White House said, this is the report we've gotten behind. And the EPA report, which scientists knew, said the exact same stuff. If anything, the NAS one was a little bit more worrisome. He said that one was unwarranted and alarmist.
And so through Carter, through Reagan, through Bush Sr., who campaigns, I'm not a denier of the science, you know, he believes in the power to do something about it. But for one reason or another, the policy is kick the can down the road. And then Jim Hansen comes along. This is the influential climate scientist. He goes to testify in Congress, and somebody in the Bush administration tries to get him to change his testimony. And this is really, this feels like a pretty big point of inflection where we go from not denial to active denial.
Yeah, it's James Hansen. It was another great scene to write. James Hansen, finally, the scientists don't want to wait. Remember, they have understood this since the later 50s, and then it is such an established thing that both the Jasons, the Manhattan Project veterans, and the National Academy of Sciences, no reason to doubt. And so finally, James Hansen asks to testify, and he testifies June 23rd, 1988. He testifies in Congress. The signature of the greenhouse effect has been discovered, and it is changing the climate now. And then when he comes back, he becomes overnight the most famous American climate scientist, and since has probably become the world's most famous climate scientist. But he comes back to testify a year later, and you know that you clear testimony in advance whenever you're a government employee. He's not a fringe figure. He works for NASA. He heads a study group at the Goddard Center that is a few blocks from Columbia. Amusingly enough, it is, I think, five stories up from the diner where Seinfeld is located. So in the 90s, two giant world-changing things, changing comedy on the first floor with coffee and omelets, and then five stories up, Dr. Hansen, five stories up, and his team are telling us, hey, the very technology that's bringing us Seinfeld is also potentially bringing us problems, and we have to solve this. So he goes, he clears his testimony. He is a NASA employee. Normally they say, okay, you can't say this. This is speculative. But there's a new wrinkle under the first President Bush. They have added testimony in. They're not scientists. And what they want him to say is, you know, my results shouldn't be counted on. my saying that temperature is going to keep rising, I don't know, half a degree a decade or half a degree every quarter of a century. You shouldn't count on it. It's just speculation. And it's a huge moment. That's the government doing it. It's not Exxon. It is a huge decision. And the weird thing, the heartbreaking thing, is that President Bush, the first President Bush, he wanted to make this a signature issue. Even his Secretary of State, Jim Baker, wanted to do it. And Jim Baker's story is a beautiful one, too. Baker had been instrumental in getting President Reagan elected and keeping him elected. And while he's there and the big man is saying this is untrue, Jim Baker, sensible person from Houston, is reading the reports and he knows it's true. And so he welcomes the United Nations IPCC, which is the Regnant Scientific Experts on this issue. And he says, I'm thrilled, I'm honored to be the first government official to welcome you to Washington. We're all on the same side. We have recognized this as a problem. And in my experience, that's always the first step to a solution. And I wish you Godspeed. That is the vibe in the first Bush White House. And their chief of staff is the person who is against this. It's just bad luck that a man named John Sununu was chief of staff. And not only does he change Professor Hansen's testimony, but President Hansen then finds out from Senator John Hines tried to get him fired from NASA. And had that not happened, we would have had a 30-year head start on the more difficult stuff that we have to do now.
And this is part and parcel to something that we haven't talked about too much so far. We've really talked primarily about politics and science. But during those same years, there's this very powerful force that started to enter the conversation, the power industry, specifically at first the National Coal Association, and then like this coalition of like 25 coal burning utilities. In 91, they produced this internal report with this novel idea. Let's position global warming as a theory, not a fact. And so this is the undercurrent that's happening as Sununu's coming in and changing Hansen's testimony. And we're moving from this period of, yes, climate change is real. Yes, it's human caused, but we have differences of opinion on what to do about it or not do about it, to this active denial.
That's right. And it's a little bit like, let's say when you're joining a new school or you're going to a party, and as you come in and you have your best clothes on and you've fixed your hair and you've shot your cuffs, and then someone is saying, that person's crazy and they're a liar, as you're shaking hands with people. And the reason that the coal industry did it, they said it's an existential issue for us. If Americans believe it, they're going to stop using coal to generate their electricity.
And there's this organization that stands up, the Information Council for the Environment. ICE, they called it ICE. This is brilliant, really. I mean, like, if it wasn't so gross, you'd just tip your hat.
Yeah. And it was also funny to see the names they rejected. So they clearly wanted to use ICE because that's a chilly name. So if you're trying to get your fingerprints on what people will think of their own opinions, it's great if it's coming from an organization called ICE. They almost used informed citizens on the environment, but then somebody was like, no, we don't want people to be informed, and we don't want them to think of themselves as citizens, and we don't want them caring about the environment. So they're saying, okay, we just can't have all three of those words together. That's how careful they were.
These groups, they start using, I mean, like, just, you know, line for line, the playbook of Big Tobacco. They question the science. They pay scientists big bucks to say that the science is wrong. They start to muddy the waters. And, you know, it's just deny, deny, deny. And this interesting thing starts happening around this same time where these groups start playing around with messages. Global warming isn't happening. Well, okay, it's happening, but it's not happening because of us. Or, you know, maybe it's, there's a guy who's like, maybe it's happening because it's God's plan. And maybe if it's God's plan, it'll actually be good for us. I mean, they're throwing.
That's the guy from Western Fuels. Yeah.
Yeah. They're throwing things against the wall to see what sticks.
That's right. They will do. That's Fred Palmer. And I think he was a sincerely religious, if slightly misguided, man. He said, there's so much coal and fuel around that we have to consider that this was God's plan to account for the tremendous success of our species. So yeah, so that maybe that will work. Maybe we can say this is part of God's plan. And what they also find, what they find that really, really works, what works is saying, we think you're on the right track. We just need you to bring us more research. And the same scientists, this was so funny and odd and sad, but thrilling to be a story that you were telling. The same scientists who they hired to say that about tobacco smoke, they were the people who then went on to start saying the same thing about global warming.
Because the goal here, much as the goal was with tobacco, was, well, this is what climate journalist Ross Gelbspan once said, the goal wasn't really to win. It was just to keep
the argument going.
Yeah.
Like, they know they're going to lose. But if you lose in 1991, you don't get all the revenue. If you lose in 2024, you have a third of a century's extra revenue to make your family happy and to make the family of your shareholders happy.
You wrote toward the end of this book that you feel like you became a pretty unpleasant person while writing it. But it's such an unpleasant story. It's full of unpleasant people. It sort of feels like that's to be expected.
Yeah. And like the reason that people can get away with stuff is because we don't have time to do the research ourselves. And it is hard. It's often the material on this is difficult. It isn't fun. And so when I would be traveling to do the research on the train or by plane, I would see people reading the kinds of books that I love, like Gone Girl or Curtis Sittenfeld or short story collections by Laurie Moore. And I thought, OK, one thing I can do with my sentimental affection for the planet and for people making good decisions is I can try to make this as good a story as those things so that it would be as fun to read as Gone Girl, except you would have a kind of Kevlar when someone came in shooting fake arguments at you, like trying to shoot climate change instead of global warming into your head. This would work as a kind of Kevlar.
The way you set up this story, there are these points along the way in which anything could have changed, where the industry of denial could have suddenly been denied the oxygen it needs to survive. But then at every turn, it finds this one molecule and it keeps burning. And so now we've got this fire, this conflagration. And so, you know, at the end of this process, I'm wondering if you feel like we'll ever be able to put out this fire of climate denial?
I would love to talk about that a little more, because I think that the issue has gotten away from us and it has fallen into, I can almost promise this is going to be my last movie reference, but this issue entered the Thunderdome of our national life. And Thunderdome is just two people enter, one person leaves. And that tends to be how we settle every issue. So it enters our national Thunderdome in the mid-50s, and the Times writes about it. Like, this is mainstream science. It's so mainstream that by the early 60s, the Times says this has been one of the primary concerns of climatologists in recent years, is why is our climate changing? When the Times writes about it in October of 1956, what they say is sometime in the future, if it's true, what's going to happen is there will be warming at the poles, which of course is where it's warming the fastest. And eventually they could be transformed into tropical jungles with tigers prowling through the underbrush and gaudy parrots squawking from the trees. That's October 1956. And then by February of 2010, when the denial movement is at its height, there is an extremely heavy snowfall in Washington on the Washington Mall, that beautiful, it's like four football fields together, that beautiful straight expanse with the Washington Monument at one end and all those wonderful Smithsonian museums on either side. Anyway, there's a heavy snowfall, and Senator James, his real middle name is Mountain, Senator James Mountain Inhofe, he and his family, they build an igloo there and they roll it together, and it's right on the Washington Mall, and they put two signs on it. The first sign is Al Gore's new home. He's being punished for caring about this issue and saying it early. And the second sign is honk if you heart global warming. And so the story, the larger story the book tells, is how we got from a parrot to an igloo. But the other story is, I don't think that has proven to be, and it's fun, I teach, as you mentioned before, and I don't know if this matches your experience too. It seems like younger people coming up now, they are less addicted to that binary than people have been in the past. And I think the reason that they're kind of moving away from it is that it's not effective. So that one of the things that's happened to the issue is that at the moment, it seems like the issue belongs to the blue team, our team, and that we use it at the same time that we don't do much about it. We use it to morally punish the red team. And it would be great if that led to sensible climate policy, but it hasn't. That approach to this issue has not yielded effective results. What I've noticed, like, I have been careful not to say the science, because it's one of those ways, the reason that someone like Frank Luntz can succeed is that aside from all the other things motivating us as people, we also want to use phrases that work as codes and that identify us as A, being on the right side, and B, being fashionable, being up to the minute. So the reason that Frank Luntz could win, and the real reason that every pleasantly coiffed, beautifully coiffed talking head on television, and every beautifully modulated speaking voice on podcasts and on National Public Radio, the reason that they would all say climate change is there's that drastic anxiety we have when we're speaking that we don't want to say something that's out of fashion. We don't want our words to be wearing bell bottoms. And so we'll say things like the science, because that's popular, or we'll even use a word like denial, which is a beautiful phrase, but it's also a phrase that takes its power from a very dark source. And so I think when people hear that, they hear that the people who are speaking to them are trying to find some kind of moral advantage in discussing it, as opposed to looking for solutions. And I think that's part of what's interesting about being human animals with a feeling of their own immortal soul somehow, or their own mortal souls, which is we feel somehow it's the part of us that was raised with grim fairy tales, that this is like Rumpelstiltskin. It's a story with a moral, which is, you know, and it goes back to something that we would make fun of from the early part of the last century. If God had intended man to fly, et cetera, et cetera. Similarly, we still have that thing. It's banked into us. And so part of us feels like, I know we shouldn't have had electricity. It's too good a deal to drive a car 2,800 miles from New York City to Los Angeles, or to go in 7 hours from New York City to Gatwick. You know, how dare we? But another way of looking at it, and the way scientists look at it, is simply, it's not a moral thing. It's just a technological problem. It's a technological problem, and it may admit to a technological solution. In the spring of 2020, when everyone was getting anxious, the government said, you have to change your life entirely. And within a few weeks, Americans responded to that challenge. They masked up, and they stayed in their homes. They stopped going to work.
David, I am so glad you're saying this. So this is such an important point, because so many people feel like our country was so divided by the pandemic. And long term, maybe that's true. But there was this point in time where we demonstrated through our actions in no time at all that we could all get on the same page. This all relates to the last words in this book, sort of pinned to the end of your acknowledgments, is this recollection of something Jim Hansen said when he went to a White House panel at the same time that this sort of kick the can strategy was morphing into the stick the spaghetti on the wall strategy. And he said the reason he was doing it was that being an eternal optimist was the only strategy that even had a chance of being effective.
Don't you love that? It's like, here's Jim Hansen. You've got to think about Jim Hansen. And it was such a pleasure to end the book with that. And thank you for seeing it. But Jim Hansen had every reason not to want to testify. George Bush's dad, this is in 2001. This is the spring of 2001. And George Bush's father's White House had not just tried to censor his testimony, but had tried to write in new things that his research didn't show. And here it is 10 years later, and it's Dick Cheney. It's an energy task force being written by Dick Cheney, and they've invited one of the most famous scientists from the other side, but he still decides to go, and with an open heart, I love this. He says, he accepted the invitation. He said, being an eternal optimist, what else could be effective? I welcome the chance. Because, of course, pessimism is never going to be effective because it makes you not try your hardest.
That's David Lipsky. He's the author of The Parrot and the Igloo. David, thank you so much.
Matthew, it was a great conversation. Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.